over time, the difference between what states need to support their Medicaid program and what the federal government contributes just gets larger and larger.
Criticism of the Senate plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, King Cove residents are cautiously optimistic about the potential for a road to Cold Bay.
After being involved in this for so long that until I see the signing on the paperwork, it's been a long battle.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
The Congressional Budget Office has what amounts to a warning for sparsely populated areas in its analysis of the Senate's draft health care reform bill. The CBO says while most insurance markets would remain stable under the Senate bill, the legislation would drive out insurers that serve a small fraction of the population, or these areas will see premiums rise very high. The CBO attributes this to the bill's lower subsidies, which it says will entice fewer people to buy insurance. The bill would end the mandate to buy insurance. And markets with few purchasers are less profitable for insurers. The CBO isn't pointing to Alaska, but no other state would lose as much in subsidies, and no other state is as sparsely populated. Judy Solomon is vice president at the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. On several scores, Solomon says she can't think of a state that fares worse in either the Senate or in the House bill than Alaska.
If it's not the worst, it's probably tied or way up there in terms of the most serious harm.
Insurers are already withdrawing from some markets under current law. The CBO did not qualify the withdrawal effect of the Senate bill. The law would impose major changes on Medicaid. The state estimates Alaska would lose $2.8 billion in Medicaid spending over 6 years if the House bill went into effect. Solomon says the Senate bill would inadequately compensate states for inflation.
Over time, the difference between what states need to support their Medicaid program and what the federal government contributes just gets larger and larger, and more costs are shifted to states.
The Senate bill has few defenders from right-wing think tanks, though the Heritage Foundation says it's better than existing law. One fan of the Senate bill is the insurer Anthem. The company says the bill will stabilize the individual market by spending $50 billion and eliminate an insurance tax. The CBO says the Senate bill will increase the number of uninsured by 22 million and reduce the deficit by $321 billion. There was a bit of a victory today for supporters of a proposed road in southwest Alaska that would connect the village of King Cove to an airport at Cold Bay via the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke announced this morning that his department has issued a permit for the study on where to put the road. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
The state of Alaska's position is that the road through Eisenbeck is necessary for medical emergencies. In bad weather, King Cove's airport is inaccessible, and residents must use boats or helicopters to get to the airport in the neighboring community of Cold Bay. Governor Bill Walker says last summer he heard many stories of injured, sick, and elderly King Cove residents risking their lives to get medical treatment.
It's going to save lives, and so this is a good first step and of many steps, but we're glad it's being taken.
The state has long sought authorization from the federal government to build the 11-mile road. Zinke's predecessor, Sally Jewell, visited the community in 2013. Later that year, she decided a road would cause irreversible damage to the refuge and the wildlife that depend on it. The area is an important feeding and resting spot for hundreds of thousands of waterfowl, including nearly the entire populations worldwide of several bird species. Village resident and King Cove Corporation spokeswoman Della Trumbull says for the human residents in the area, the road is a life or death issue. And after today's announcement, Trumbull says she's not holding her breath.
A good part of our lives has been advocating for this road for this community, and I tell you, after being involved in this for so long, that until I see the signing on the paperwork, it's been a long battle.
Alaska's congressional delegation continues to push for approval of federal legislation in the U.S. House and Senate seeking the road. For Alaska Public Media, I'm Casey Grove.
Two more Alaskans were mauled by bears in Alaska over the weekend, bringing the number of bear attacks in the state to 4 in less than a week, including 2 fatal ones. 2 people were injured in separate brown bear attacks on Saturday, one on military land in Anchorage and the other near the community of Hope. 2 other people were killed last week in separate black bear attacks, one a 16-year-old boy taking part in a mountain race in Anchorage, and the other was a mine contract worker attacked near the Pogo mine. A popular wilderness race has been suspended for 1 year following the fatal maulings. University of Alaska Anchorage officials say the suspension will allow them to add more communications, resources, and medical support to the 24-mile Crow Pass crossing race between Eagle River and Girdwood. The race was scheduled for July 22nd. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, good news for Copper River dip netters.
So we're back to the standard regulations for the person use fishery, where your bag limit may include a single king salmon for the entire season.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A 62-year-old Juneau woman has received one of the nation's top awards recognizing traditional folk art. Chilkat weaver Anna Brown Ellers is one of 9 fellows named this week by the National Endowment for the Arts. KTOO's Jacob Resnick has more.
The NEA's Director of Folk and Traditional Arts, Clifford Murphy, says this year's National Heritage Fellows are a diverse lot.
If you look at this year's class of fellows, you have Anna Brown Ellers, who's a Chilkat weaver. You have Phil Wiggins, who's a blues harmonica player from the metro Washington, D.C. area. And then you have many things in between, you know, craft, dance, music. It's pretty extraordinary.
Chilkat weaving is an indigenous art form practiced by coastal people in southeast Alaska and British Columbia. Traditionally, mountain goat wool is woven on a loom and blended with thin strips of cedar bark to create elaborately patterned blankets.
One thing that is just stunningly beautiful about it is that to see something like this outside in the natural environment, it's like the colors are utterly complementary to the landscape. These are the colors that you see in your trees and in your waterways and on the mountainside. It's really quite striking.
Anna Brown Ellers was born and raised in Juneau. Her ancestors come from Clukwan.
The designs on the Chilkat blanket represent our clans. So the designs say who you are and by knowing that, okay, I'm from the Whale House, people know where you're from. And it's not an ownership of the land. It's our identity.
She says the art seemed to come easy for her when she started in the early 1980s.
Once I started, it was as if I had always done it. It was kind of deja vu. So I'm really happy to be included in this group. And I'm really satisfied that us Chilkat Tlingit Indians are included.
One of the challenges, she says, is gathering the traditional materials needed. She says her children have helped her since they were old enough to use a knife.
We prepare the materials in the springtime, and whenever mountain goat hunters call me and ask me to meet them at the ferry terminal or they send me a hide on a plane, my children and friends and relatives of mine, they all show up and work the mountain goat together. And it's not a fun job, that part, I can tell you, but it's a necessity.
She spoke of one of her latest works, an 8-foot by 7-foot blanket with the design of a newborn orca.
When I finished that one, I did some research on the baby killer whales, and when they're newborn, they're 7 feet long, and they weigh 400 pounds. And that weaving, the killer whale, was exactly 7 feet wide. So it's a life-size killer whale.
Ehlers and the other eight National Heritage Fellows will receive $25,000 and be feted at a September awards ceremony in Washington, D.C. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Chitna dip netters are now able to harvest a king salmon. The usual allowance in the popular Copper River personal use fishery is back after being rescinded this spring out of concern about a weak king run. With the commercial and subsistence harvests indicating a better than anticipated return, fishing restrictions have been pulled back. State Area Management Biologist Mark Somerville says that was extended to the personal use dip net fishery at Chitna as of Monday the 19th.
Standard regulations for the person use fishery where your bag limit may include a single king salmon for the entire season.
Somerville says upriver sport fish harvest of king salmon from Copper River and its tributaries could be further liberalized depending on upriver counts. Sport fishers are currently allowed to take two king salmon annually from two different locations in the Copper River system.
14,000 king salmon taken in the commercial fishery, and we anticipate somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 king salmon taken in the upriver fisheries combined. And that'll still leave us enough fish to meet our escapement goal of 24,000.
Meanwhile, Somerville says the Copper River's more abundant sockeye run is shaping up to come in right around preseason forecast of 1.8 million fish, a slightly below average return. An archaeologist says there may be the remains of a historic Aleutic fish trap on the north end of Kodiak Island. He says those types of man-made formations are rare to discover in the region. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
The Aleutic Museum is in its second year of documenting ancestral sites on Afognak Native Corporation lands. While surveying one area, museum curator of archaeology Patrick Saltonstall says he noticed something on the shoreline at low tide. He says he identified it as a fish trap, which he calls a corral.
They're like stone walls in the intertidal zone. So when the tide came in, you know, all the fish waiting to go upstream would float in over the corrals or the trap. And then when the tide went out, they'd be stranded in the pens. And so then you could catch a whole lot of fish.
He says it can be challenging to determine whether a corral is natural or man-made, but he says he sees evidence of it being a fish trap.
I could tell that there were some boulders that they used that were there already, but almost all of it was bringing boulders in. And there, it's like a wall, like 5 feet across and maybe 2 feet high now, but probably much higher in the day.
Sonstall says this is the first time he's ever seen a corral like this one on the island, but they're common in Southeast, which he says could be because the people there use them more frequently.
But another thing is a lot of the places down there are more protected. They aren't as open to the ocean as Kodiak is, so maybe the lower energy, they tend to be preserved better.
He says they found what looks like petroglyphs nearby, speckled dots and incised lines carved into slate.
And what's the cool pattern is they all seem to be associated with these with fishing localities. You know, you look at the typical petroglyphs, you know, with faces, whales, you know, drummer. They're associated more with whaling or with villages.
He says it's hard to determine the age of either the corral or the petroglyphs, but based on nearby archaeological sites, the carvings could be dated back to about 500 years ago. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
In Kotzebue, an aging trove of Inupiat photographs, books, and recordings are at risk of further deteriorating are being assessed in the hope they can be digitized for future use. Akaluk Memorial Trust, a cultural arm of Nana Regional Corporation, received a small grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to bring in a preservation specialist to examine the materials. More than 4,000 items, including 500 recordings made from 1965 into the 1980s, are in the collection. Arctic Sounder reporter Shady Grove Oliver says the nearly 50-year-old recordings include conversations with elders, highlighting the importance of understanding what it means to be Inupiaq.
And this sort of happened at the same time as a lot of the land claims discussions were happening, the times when the Native corporations were coming into being. They also, in some cases, they document things like the meetings that took place throughout the Northwest Arctic to discuss what people wanted their Inupiaq values to be. As in, if you go to that area now, there's a lot of pride in one's Inupiaq values, and it's this agreed-upon set of values that were actually determined, agreed upon at that time. So they have recordings of the original conversations discussing things as personal as what it means to be an Inupiaq person.
And Shady, what else is within this vast collection? What else have you discovered or have you been told about what's contained within these archives?
The tapes are really sort of the central focus to some degree. There's more than 4,000 items altogether in this collection, and there's about 700 cassette tapes. So as a group, they're one of the most important parts of it. And I'd like to point out some of the other things that are actually in these tapes that I've had described to me. There's conversations with elders that are actually in Inupiaq. And that's really important because there are a lot of people nowadays who are trying to learn the language as second language learners, as in they didn't grow up speaking their native language. And so these tapes are a really important original document of the language as spoken by fluent native speakers. In addition, there's recordings of elders talking about migration patterns, hunting and fishing traditions, traditional medicine, weather patterns. So a lot of things that would actually help communities nowadays understand where they are and how they got here, even if they weren't able to speak to those elders that had that information themselves.
It sounds as if some of that information could be valuable baseline for climate change research and other scientific initiatives.
I know people are interested in seeing what's actually on these tapes, and I say that because they're so fragile at this point. You know, we know that tapes can last for 25 to 30 years fairly comfortably, but some of these tapes are pushing 50 plus years at this point. So because they're so fragile, many of these haven't actually been heard in a long time. So in terms of climate change, if we could hear firsthand what conditions were like in the 1960s and 70s, that would help back up what some of the elders are saying today. That would help lay this baseline so we could understand how have the caribou migration patterns changed. Did the migration routes originally go through some villages and not others? How far out did the sea ice extend? And by having that data, we can better understand sort of the rate and way things have changed over the last 50 years.
Shady Grove Oliver is a reporter with the Arctic Sounder. Akaluk Memorial Trust officials hope the current assessment will help support a request for future grant funds to preserve the archives and make them available for public use.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Southeast offers the Finnish College Alaska Initiative, designed with flexible online learning options and customized degree programs. It's college that fits life, work, and play schedules while earning a degree. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August the 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by UAS.
What began as an idea between two friends turned into an LGBTQ plus pride event that drew hundreds of people to Talkeetna on Sunday. KTNA's Philip Manning was there and has the story.
Talkeetna's first Pride Parade brought in a larger crowd than expected this weekend, with an estimated 300 participants. As people gathered in a village park sporting colorful outfits, face paint, and rainbow flags, Daphne Duall-Lachores, a drag queen and entertainer from Anchorage, took to the microphone.
Good afternoon and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Talkeetna, Alaska. How's everybody doing today? We want to welcome you to the first ever Pride Parade, Pride Extravaganza here. How many people are gay today? It's Pride Day in Talkeetna. Everybody's gay, isn't that right?
The event began as an idea between two local teens, Celeste Harrell and Lillian Rust. Celeste says the concept began with a single conversation and a schedule conflict.
About 2 weeks ago, a little less than that actually, her and I were just hanging out and she wanted me to come to the Anchorage Parade. But I had work. And so she was like, hey, maybe we can have something Sunday. And I was like, oh, sure, I have the day off. So that's how this endeavor happened.
Initially, Lillian and Celeste expected around 70 people. Word spread quickly about the Pride event on social media, however. The end result was a significant local turnout alongside many who drove from Anchorage or elsewhere in the MATSU to participate. One of the people who made the drive is RJ Johnson, who grew up in Talkeetna but now lives in Anchorage. RJ is used to being on the planning end of Pride events. He says seeing his hometown celebrate in the very park where he played growing up is special.
This is amazing. You know, in Anchorage, I've always been part of a committee or part of a planning for everything. For out here, like being the first one, this is what Pride's all about, just people coming together and celebrating.
After about an hour of mingling, the parade began. As they made the customary two laps of Main Street, parade participants were greeted with waves and cheers from spectators. For a short while, Talkeetna's bustling summer activity stopped as rainbow flags, signs, and chants filled the street. After the parade, the celebration continued in the village park. Lillian Rust says she's grateful for everyone who supported Talkeetna's first Pride Parade.
Yeah, it turned out better than I even anticipated. It was a lot less stressful or nerve-wracking than I, you know, even thought. Just getting started, you know, was all that it took. And really, the support from everyone was what really got it rolling.
While no official plans are being made yet, many who attended Talkeetna's first Pride celebration say they hope it's not the last. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Homer is known as the halibut fishing capital of the world, but charter operators aren't targeting only the prized bottom fish these days. An ongoing study published in the scientific journal Public Library of Science aims to find out how charter operators' fishing habits have evolved and the ripple effect of their decisions. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has the story.
University of Alaska Fairbanks PhD candidate Maggie Chan wants to know how and why the fishing charter industry is changing in southeast and south central Alaska. Chan, an associate professor of fisheries, Ann Boudreau, interviewed several fishing charter owners in Sitka and Homer, most of whom have been around since the 1990s. Part one of Chan's study focuses on where charters are taking their customers.
So in a way, I'd like to think of this first paper as putting the picture frame down, and we're going to start filling in the picture of what people are seeing on the water, the changes they've seen over time, in the next few papers.
This is important because popular fishing grounds are chosen not just for the availability of fish, but the variety of species that can be caught in one place. Chan found in the early 1990s, charters primarily targeted halibut around Kachemak Bay and in Lower Cook Inlet. In the latter part of the decade, fishermen started offering multi-species trips.
But when we see the addition of combination or multi-species trips, people were traveling further south to the Barron and Chugach Islands. And that is very distinctly associated with a multi-species trip because there's more habitat down there for things like lingcod, rockfishes, etc.
When fuel prices hit an all-time high in 2008, the study found fishermen started staying closer to town. Captain Greg's Charters owner Greg Sutter has been guiding fishing trips around Homer since 1995. Sutter caters to families and large groups, and he says multi-species trips are still in high demand.
You know, when they come up to Alaska, they're not only looking for the adventure, they would like to bring home as much meat as they can.
Chan conducted her interviews in 2014 and 2015. During that time, the decisions Homer charter operators were making were mostly business-driven. Fishermen in Sitka say they chose their fishing grounds because of regulations imposed by the International Pacific Halibut Commission. Homer charter operations have seen halibut regulations come down since. The Halibut Commission started cutting out days of the week operators could target the bottom fish. Sutter says multi-species trips have picked up some of the slack, but he's turned away customers and has canceled advance bookings for halibut trips.
You know, we can try to sell a salmon trip, which, you know, some Wednesdays I'm able to, but not every Wednesday.
Chan doesn't just want to know what's driving fishermen like Sutter's choices. In subsequent papers, she will lay out what changes anglers are seeing in the waters they fish. She hopes her study will spur conversation between fishery managers and fishermen, Chan says that dialogue can help decision makers make big picture management decisions. Scott Meyer is a fishery biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Homer. Meyer collaborated on the study, and he agrees the study's findings could be valuable for both federal and state fishery managers.
It just helps everybody understand what the behavioral response by the charter fishery is to changes in halibut regulations.
Chan and Boudreau plan to publish the rest of the study within the next year. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
On a cool Sunday evening in Ketchikan, Team Heart of Gold's Carl Kruger became the first person to finish the Race to Alaska on a stand-up paddleboard. KRBD's Emma Atkinson was there to meet him at the dock.
The third time is indeed the charm for Carl Kruger after attempting the Race to Alaska in 2015 and 2016. Clad in a wetsuit and hat, the ponytailed Kruger looks relieved as he steps off his board and onto the dock. He rings the finishing bell and hugs his wife, Jessica, and their daughter. Someone in the crowd mentions that he looks as if he's lost weight. Kruger turns to his wife and asks if it's true. She nods, laughing. Kruger looks down at his daughter.
You got taller. I got skinnier, you got taller.
Race co-founder Daniel Evans stands at the front of a crowd of about 30 or 40 people.
You know, there's so many of us there. I've been trying to find the words to describe what you've done. none of them seem adequate.
Kruger says he learned a lot during his 15 days on the board.
You know, I've never been a patient person. I had to work a whole lot on that. This trip. Yeah, a whole lot.
It's a good thing.
Despite training twice a week for a year prior to the race, Kruger says there were some days when it almost got to be too much.
There were days where just every single stroke was a barrier. And I just wanted to stop. Everything was screaming at me to stop.
More difficult than the physical challenge, though, was the toll the race took on his mindset.
It's just paddling, you know. The rest of it was just knowing the water and making decisions, you know. The hard part was the mental.
As he cracks open a celebratory beer, Liz Harpold of the Northwest Maritime Center captures the moment on Facebook Live.
Anything you want to say to the fans on Facebook that are watching?
Blazing hard thing to do. I say bring it. I'd love to see people try this again next year. I really would.
After this year's finish, who knows? Perhaps next year's Race to Alaska winner will be a man with a paddle and a heart of gold. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Emma Atkinson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Emma Atkinson in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.